EMS report.
So, Dr. Stratton. Dr. Stratton might be here late if he can make it here, so I'll defer that to the end if he's here. If not, then I can go ahead and give it, so we'll defer the medical director's report.
Okay. Hospital diversion, we have that on attachment two.
So in your packet, usually I do report of diversion by quarter, but for this group, we decided to go ahead and do a January, February, since we're already into February, and the diversion has spiked a little bit in February, so.
Which page are you looking at?
We're looking at all the pages. So if we start on page two, two, three, and four are divided out by areas, and they show diversion by hospital as percent of time on diversion. And so all the areas seem to be kind of equally affected by a spike in diversion. If we look at page three at the bottom, I just want to make sure everyone's clear that the two graphs on the bottom, there's one on the left, one on the lower right. One of them says number of days by month on diversion, and the other one says number of days over year on diversion. This is just a reference point, so if you were to pick a number like 10% and say a hospital is on diversion for 10% of the month, the chart on the left will show you that that would equal out to about 3 days of having your hospital closed. The chart on the right, if you were to maintain that 10% for the whole year, month over month, that would equate to 36.5 days. So these are here just kind of as a reference point to get an idea and conceptualize, all right, what does 5% mean, or 2% or 10%, and kind of give you a reference point as to how many days that would actually be if the hospital was closed that long. So on page five, you'll see emergency receiving center diversion. So this is reported in total hours. The previous charts are reported in percent of time. This is total hours, so it's same data, just a little different perspective. We see for January, total hours countywide was 930. For February was 1341. So we spiked a little bit in February. If we compare that to last year, January last year was 2232.78. And February last year was 871.59. So it looks like we're having a little bit of a later spike this year due to kind of a little bit of a late start in flu season. Page six shows year-over-year diversion for 2012 through 2015 and reported by month in total hours. So again, you can see the spike in January and February for all county diversion. Page seven is trauma diversion. All the trauma centers went up a little bit in February as well. Page eight is CVRC, or cardiovascular receiving center diversion. So any reported diversion reports highlighted there in red, and then it's as percent of time. And I said highlighted in red, and you guys don't have color copies, so. Page nine is internal disruption. Percent of time hospitals were on internal disruption, pretty low there. And then CT diversion, percent of time hospitals were on CT diversion.
Okay. Any questions on the diversion? February was more difficult than January. I think the last couple days it's been less busy. I don't know if you guys have noticed that. So hopefully we're over the worst part. Influenza?
So under attachment three, there's a from Orange County Public Health IM influenza report. And again, it just shows influenza activity continues to be elevated in Orange County. To date, we have received 30 reports of influenza cases. So, and this report is through as of week seven, week ending 2/20/16. So.
Okay, good. Okay, any questions? Unfinished business, we have policy revisions.
So policy revisions, public comment period. Last go around ended, public comment period ended January 8th of 2016. We are currently looking at all of the public comment responses and developing responses or modifications to the policies. One policy in particular, 310.10, there was a request that it go back out for public comment. So I just want to let this group know that we do intend to put it out for public comment. It will probably be placed sometime in March. We will have a series of more policies going out for public comment April 1st, but this particular policy may come out a little bit sooner, and it will go out for...
That one, the 310.10, what does that cover? It sounds familiar to me, but I can't...
310.10 is determination of transport to an appropriate facility, so it's a diversion policy and destination policy. So that one will actually go out, since it already went out for a 50-day, it'll go back out for a 15-day public comment period. And we'll send notice via eGov. If you haven't signed up for our notifications, left-hand side of our main homepage, there's a subscribe bulletins. You can access there and subscribe to all of our reports that we push out for different categories.
Pediatric readiness survey? Or, okay, EPCR availability.
EPCR availability, this has been a standing item on this subcommittee agenda, and we've decided to leave it on just to continue to remind facilities if they're having a problem getting reports, PCRs from the field, that there are designated contacts for each of the agencies that you can call and at 24/7 and receive those PCRs. So we continue to encourage facilities, if they're having problems, to use that method of obtaining the PCRs.
Pediatric readiness.
In 2012, the facilities engaged in a pediatric readiness survey, and they were given a readiness score that was then given back to the facilities based on the questions and answers in the pediatric readiness survey. It's come time to do another survey, and so for 2016, what we're going to do is put together another pediatric readiness survey, ask all the facilities that they complete the readiness survey. Once they submit it back, they'll get an updated score, and they'll be able to compare what their previous score was to their current score to see if there's any improvement or changes into what they're doing for pediatric readiness.
Sepsis.
EMS is working on sepsis standing orders for the field, so in looking to identify early identification of patients who may be septic. And so this is kind of a notification for facilities so that they know the pre-hospital system may be telling you in advance this has been identified as a sepsis patient based on protocol. And if facilities have sepsis programs in place, it'll just kind of be an early notification opportunity for them to mobilize that. Kind of like STEMI and stroke, where you get an early notification, but...
You know. Anybody else doing that in the country?
You bet. Yep. Numerous areas that I do some work with already have them in place, decreasing door to antibiotic time.
Great. Cool. Okay. Any questions on that? Anything on unfinished business that you want to talk about before we go on to new business?
I just have a question. Sorry, everybody, I'm late. I'm late with the hospital. last time, Dr. Stratton gave an update on a stroke redesignation survey, and I wondered if you guys have an updated timeline on when you'd be looking at that.
I do not have an updated timeline on when we'll be looking at the actual stroke kind of structure and stroke distribution of patients in the county. Right now we're working on a stroke database where we enter stroke data in. Right now it's a kind of a paper process, and we're looking to move it to electronic database, which will make it easier for the facilities to provide stroke data that's required by policy. And it's a kind of a more formalized registry, and it will allow the stroke centers to get more real-time data back as well, so there's some benefits to that. So
So those changes would come to this committee before they would go to an EMCC level meeting, or
changes
they just go to any changes in you know, the hub and spoke model or anything like that? Would those have to come to this committee first? Yeah. Okay.
Those would come through this committee first. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, ReadyNet entry data.
So we're doing a great job at pulling diversion data and finding out, you know, what the percentage of time hospitals are on diversion or number of hours. An area that we noticed we're kind of falling a little bit short on is what are the reasons, there's categorized reasons of why we're going on diversion, and that's not always being documented consistently, and for some facilities it's not being documented at all. It would be helpful to kind of have an idea of why facilities were going on diversion. The categories are there, but we feel like maybe there's an opportunity to look at the categories and determine, are the categories correct? Maybe the facilities aren't answering the data because the category doesn't make sense for why they're going on diversion. Maybe there has to be more categories or less, or maybe the language has to be clarified in within those categories so that when a facility does go on diversion, they can state the reason why. Then we can have a better idea of, you know, is it an influx of patients? Do they have critical patients? Do they have holds? Or whatever the reason is for the facility. And so we wanted to bring it to this group and then also maybe see if there's interest to form a subcommittee that maybe can meet once or twice to look at the categories and see if they make sense from a facility standpoint. And see if we need to do any revisions before we go on and address the issue with facilities individually.
I'm kind of an advocate, as I mentioned before, of doing away with the diversion going on a system somewhat like Riverside, where they have another way of kind of monitoring whether a hospital should be diverted from. I think it's wall time as far as paramedics if they start stacking up. Is there any thought about doing away with diversion?
We haven't. I believe that was brought up in the distant past.
Probably by me.
And I'm not sure. I think it was before I came to the agency, so I'm not sure where that ended or you know what the movement was on that.
We got real close, but I don't think we ever. It was 2009.
I mean, what are your thoughts about that? I mean, I don't know how many hospitals we have represented here, but it's just, it seems like there's, to make a decision whether you're going to go on diversion, unless there's a, it's just hard to determine whether a hospital should go on diversion or not go on diversion based upon the inpatient beds, the ER beds, the number of people coming through, the number of holes. And I don't know if we're ever going to be able to, from this agency, make a decision as to whether a hospital should or should not go on diversion. So then what are we talking about when we get into these meetings? I don't know. But
well, at Saddleback, we do go on diversion way too often. I feel, as the director, I feel that way, but I'm not out there.
Right.
At the bedside with those nurses and those physicians dealing with an influx. And it's dependent on our base hospital too. If they go on diversion or if they decide to move more patients to Saddleback and our acuity is up, you know, nursing will sometimes look at the volume and other times they'll look at the acuity, and they'll also get pressure from the physicians that are on duty too. So it's dependent on so many different avenues. You know, certain physicians are like, ah, I'm going diversion, and they're down without thinking it through. So I think if we can come up with some criteria that will help physicians and nurses make that decision clearer instead of, oh, it's just too busy, let's just go on diversion, that will help me too, instead of having to beat my staff up constantly to don't go on diversion, but I'm not there feeling the impact. Yeah. You know, it's so I have to know what their feelings are. I think we need more discussion with the hospitals to see what they're in.
I mean, part of the problem is if nobody could look at the ReadyNet and see what other people are doing, but too often nurses are looking at the ReadyNet and say, oh, they're on diversion. We got to go on diversion because we're going to get slammed, which we probably will get. And I think if nobody's allowed to go in diversion, then it's the same thing as the people coming in the front door through the waiting area. You just have to suck it up and figure out how to do it. And I think the fluxes, ups and downs, will be less because everybody will be continuing to take paramedics. Now, in Riverside, as I understand it, they have a system where if the paramedics and the rigs start not being attended to for a half hour, in other words, wall time is more than a half hour, then they put the hospital on automatically on diversion. Somebody calls in and says, from the paramedics or the ambulance, and says, you know, we've been waiting here 45 minutes, and then they put them on diversion. I think that would be a more reasonable thing to do than, because I just see, you know, personalities in the emergency department are the ones that are making a decision based upon, you know,
real
how
time,
crazy
right
they
now.
Think it is. And,
yes,
and
I totally agree. I mean, because who's on, what charge nurse? And we come in and we question it. They get upset. Who are you challenging?
That's
we're
exactly
the expert.
Right.
And they pull out D-docs, documents, and we're in this
That's
fight.
Right.
Then I got licensing coming down saying, hey, what's going on here? You know, it's like a mess for
That's
something
right.
that should be just as simple as that.
Yeah.
If it's just too crowded,
we formalized the process where January we were getting killed. We were going on diversion a lot. So we set up this the number of beds, the number of holes, the acuity, the number of the waiting room.
Knee docs.
We didn't go with knee docs because if you went by knee docs, you would actually end up being on diversion.
All the time.
All the time.
Right.
We set up an internal system, and our diversion in February was lower than we, even though our volumes were crazy, because we took the charge nurse, the doctors kind of out of the loop, and we said, no, actually, we don't need to go on diversion based on the stats right now.
And your doc, you know, some of your nurses and docs will get upset.
They will.
You know, and you could possibly be reported to the DHS for unsafe conditions. I just think that I think we need to get out of this. Or at least what I'd like us to consider doing is to do an evaluation of other counties throughout the state, perhaps, and see the different models and see whether they have successfully, if they do away with diversion, whether it's helped or hindered.
I've been in several environments that have had significant diversion, primarily starting around 1999, spiking in the mid, 2005, 2006. A lot of them have done away with diversion. The expected outcome was increased wall time, and then at which point everybody backpedaled again, but what a lot of the EMS services did started coming up with different ideas, either operation supervisors, et cetera, in the ED to assist in facilitation. Some counties in California actually place an EMS person in the emergency department, and they'll drop off a patient to one of their EMS colleagues so the ambulance can go back and service. So there's all different potential ways that this is being handled around the country.
Orange County overall, statewide, when we meet with our the other LEMSes, we are in very good position. There was a last year or late 2014, California Hospital Association, in conjunction with the EMS Authority, produced a toolkit for reducing wall time and how do we address the wall time issue. It touched also on diversion because what Dr. Broman just said, you go on diversion, now what you're doing is you're increasing your wall times, and we're putting pressure then on the EMS system, the ambulance, the paramedics, and the fire department. So we're just shifting. So when we look at where Orange County is, I was one of the very few administrators who, answering the survey of, you know, how many hours of wall time do you have? We don't have hours of
wall
time.
That was my next thing, yeah. How do we monitor wall time?
So why I don't see that as a move step forward to have lots of wall time. I see that as a step back.
And that's what hospitals do. So you're talking about the emotion and the anxiety of the ER physicians and the charge nurses who are there making decisions, but you're also, let's swing the pendulum this way, when those same staff are told by their administration, do not go on diversion for anything, and they absolutely have every reason to go on diversion. And so what do they do to manage it? They have wall time wall time, wall time. And then when we get the phone calls, hey, our units have been on the wall here for 4 hours. It's like, why aren't they on diversion? That's how we manage this.
How do you manage it?
Well, what
shift? We shift the patients to another. That hospital goes on diversion.
I mean,
and
you're
patients
saying
don't
you
go
manage, manage it by wall, by diversion, or you go to talk to the
well,
hospital?
Are we monitoring wall time? I mean, we don't even have.
That's how the hospitals are handling the fact that they can't or are not aren't going on diversion is they have increased wall time. So it's solving their problem, but what it's impacting is the EMS system and the next acute patient coming in.
Do we have a way of measuring wall time?
So there's. We have the ability to do it. We're not tracking it so much. We have pockets here and there and incidents to where we haven't felt like we needed to constantly trend it or monitor it. But there was when we get the call on Friday night at 4 o'clock, we try to push it to the ED directors and say, because they don't want to get a call from us saying, hey, why are the ambulance companies calling me? Oh my gosh, let me take care of my ER here. But last year there was legislation passed effective January 1st requiring that the state establish definitions and standards for monitoring and figuring out how to solve the wall time issue. Because in Isima and Riverside, inland counties, they have hours and hours of wall time. Hours. And up north, so much so that they're posting how much and how much unit hours is what the cost is for their staff in on the hospital campus to stay there until the hospital takes over to show, you know, we're lose. This is how much money it's costing. Maybe they, you know, then the next step is hospitals should pick that up. But bottom line is the state is forming a task group to establish the definitions and so that we're all talking about the same thing, so that wall time here is the same defined as Riverside. And actually getting back to that toolkit by CHA, and I think Whitney, you have it, and I think all the hospitals received it. That actually has the definite, I mean, the work's already done. We just need to promulgate it and get it quiet. But we just don't have, doesn't mean that we won't have it, but we're in a very fortunate position when we compare ourselves to
in regards to wall time, when I worked in emergency room in San Bernardino County, a lot of the times the monitor tech or the unit secretary did keep track of the wall time, anything over 10 minutes. So a unit would come in and they would write down the time. What time did that unit arrive? And that was just the standard. That's what they did. And I'm sure rolling that out from scratch, it would probably be difficult for everyone to get their monitor techs or unit secretaries to do that. But it became the standard. That was when the paramedic walks through the door with the patient, they write down that time. And then when the patient gets to a bed, they write down that time.
Well, with all our electronic records, there must be some way of capturing this.
We just need to make sure that everybody's capturing it
calling
the same
at the
way.
Same time.
Right. So every time we get some type of report of time, we ask for the data. Send us the record. Where are you at? Who have you talked to? And sometimes we get it, sometimes we don't, sometimes it works itself.
But it is a schizophrenic system, because if you get the records and the wall times are excessive, and then you go back to the hospital and say, you should have gone on diversion. And then the next day you come back and say your diversion times are too great. What message are you sending? I mean, it is an impossible and a schizophrenic type of system where you're saying, go on diversion, yet don't go on diversion. I think. I mean, unless I'm missing something here.
Well, and from the private side, you guys are all talking about the paramedics and getting them back out into the field, and God bless 911. But I work with IFT paramedics that they are seen as a lesser set of patients, so they wind up sitting on the wall. And again, it's pockets, it's here and there, and I bypass you guys and just go and have the conversation with the ER manager. But I think we're forgetting about the BLS IFT group, which, first of all, they're not all on electronic documentation, so that data that we're looking at is not accurate because it's not representation of the 26 companies that we've got out there. And I've been in the ER where I go, oh, you're BLS, you can sit on the wall, but I got to get the paramedic back out to the field is my mindset. when in reality your sickest patients are sitting on that BLS gurney, and they're the ones that wind up suffering, and they're the ones that have the utilization hours that are going through the roof and can't get back to the dialysis calls and the other stuff that they're doing. So when we talk about this, we have to look at the whole system, not just 911. It's valuable, but it's not the whole system.
I mean, as an example, I had a complaint from a patient who was brought from quite a distance to Fountain Valley a couple months ago, and she had they had to wait on the wall for I think it was less than a half hour, but she was upset at that, and she said, "Why didn't you go down?" Oh, well, we went into the ReadyNet, and all the other hospitals were down. So because we stayed up, because we try to stay up, and other hospitals had gone down, and they probably should have gone down, I don't know. But then we get blamed because we stayed up and we should have gone down. Okay, now if we had gone down, then everybody goes back up. Well, does that make any sense? If everybody's down and everybody goes back up, I mean, how do you rationalize that? If you're down, you're down. So, I mean, the whole system, I think it would be easier if from my point of view, if everybody stays up, I think it'll level it out. They'll be less likely being brought into a hospital that happened not to go down, but they got 10 ambulances because everybody else is down. I mean, it is a crazy situation.
Well, there's a false sense of security when you go on diversion. It's very false because the majority of our hospital patients, they walk in the front door. Right. The majority of our volume is walk-ins. It's right. Not EMS, even though it is a significant amount. And so it gives everyone a false sense of security that they're going to be okay when you've got 35 in the waiting room.
Right.
So that's part of it, and there's a culture. Each organization has their own culture, and that has to be looked at as well as what rationale are they using for wall time, for diversion, for being up, for acuity, for everything. It's a very large problem to tackle, and it's one way is not going to solve the other way. It's one's going to have an effect on the other unless we look at the whole thing, and it's a big problem.
Well, one way we can measure is everybody has dispatch, mm-hmm. and if we can measure arrival time at the hospital to clearing the hospital, then it measures everyone equally, assuming that they all. I mean, there's several dispatch systems, so it would be. The trouble would be collecting all that data, but at least we have an idea of how long.
Yeah, but remember, there's a difference between turning the patient over versus clearing for the next call.
Yeah.
And there's systems that actually, you know, base it on signature at the time of turnover, you know, nursing signature that's caught in an electronic medical record.
Sure.
So, I mean.
But that's not always the time they're done. There may be further documentation that needs to be taken care of prior to being available. Now, if they're there for 45 minutes, I would expect that they've probably got all that documentation done.
Let's hope so, yes.
hopefully that signature's the last thing, but, you know, there's other times when it's not.
Right.
So, at least it's a somewhat equitable, you know, not just, hey, they can get them in first or whatever. And,
well, I think one of the things that's going to aid it is when we all get on electronic documentation, which we have to be by the end of the year, and we'll be on the Elite platform, so. And then everybody, BLS, 911, IFT, ALS, everybody will be on it, which will aid EMS and then reports and looking at the data.
Well, and then the benefit of the dispatch systems is they're 24 hours a day, right? They're the ones that are saying, hey, this hospital has, you know, 8 units at it that have been there for an hour, you know, and this one next door has, nobody's been there for more than a half hour. You know?
Right.
I don't know if that would be something that could all go up on some kind of collective area. You know, this hospital's a red because they've got all these units waiting, and this one's a yellow.
Yeah. And I think what you have to kind of realize in emergency medicine is there are times in surges that every ER bed is filled with critical patients, and there are critical patients out in the waiting room. So you, every single bed in all the hospitals, and then you bring in ambulances that have less critical patients on than the patients in the waiting room. And that's a judgment by the nursing and the physician staff. And you, the best thing for all the patients is to have that patient that's less sick stay on that ambulance gurney. I'm sorry, It's just the way life is in the emergency department.
And I would take it a step further, though, and say that the best thing would be for that patient not to come in the first place. If there's another hospital that can easily accept that patient, that's what diversion is all about, allowing those hospitals that are impacted to offload on the hospitals that are not.
But in my scenario, I had everybody being killed. Okay, everybody's being killed, and that happens.
That does.
That happens, okay. And so it just, there is not going to be a system that will allow every ambulance to get off immediately all the time, because all the there are times when all the hospitals are completely filled. So I don't know.
So are we going to look at an alternative that is diversion, or we? So I would support.
I would support common definitions and common what's the word I'm looking for? Kind of what you guys did. Guidelines. I would support that, but I don't support doing away with diversion, not at this point in time. At least for our facility, we have a capacity issue. It would kill us, and it might kill some patients. That's the problem.
But could we as a group recommend a set of guidelines that you would have a certain level of critical patients, certain number of patients in the waiting room, certain number of hours?
Well, we've all used NEDUX, okay? Yeah. And what does that show you? You're in the black all the time.
Yeah.
So it's of no value, right?
No, it isn't.
It's of no value.
And right now, they're looking at the ratios, too. So they're looking at what your ratio is. You define for me what the ratio is in the ER when a patient changes acuity all the time. Okay? And now, you know, the CDPH is looking at it going, oh my goodness, you didn't have enough staff based on your acuity. For that minute? I mean, it's a tough call, because then the nurses are now at a point saying, okay, we're just like the floor. We're out of ratio. Go down.
Right. Well, I mean, maybe what we can just do, I don't know if your office can kind of check around if there's a website on kind of how others are doing it and what their success and failures and thoughts are. I mean, obviously, people gone off the diversion and then a year later have gone back on diversion, you know, then probably doesn't make any difference. But everybody that's gone off the diversion wants to stay off of the diversion. It seems to work better in some ways overall, then maybe we should consider. So I don't know. Is that something you guys could possibly?
We can share the statewide survey.
Okay,
we can
great.
Do like a quick lit review as well.
Okay, great. And any other, I think we've killed this topic. And there is no right answer, I know that. Okay, let's, other business?
Continuing on new business.
Oh, do we have more new business?
Hospital.
Yes, hospital closure.
Oh, yes. Attachment 4.
So under attachment 4 is a notification I went out to the system. This month we received notification that Saddleback Memorial Medical Center San Clemente is announced of their intent to close the emergency department effective May 31st, 2016. And so in line with that, we're following Orange County EMS Policy 615, which requires Orange County EMS to do a evaluation, impact evaluation, and report that impact evaluation to the California Department of Public Health. So we're in the process of looking at that impact evaluation and pulling the data and elements together for that. We will have a public hearing as well for that. That's part of the requirement to hold a public hearing on with the impact evaluation results. And looking at April 29th at EMCC for that public hearing.
Okay. Any?
We're trying to. So the. What are your thoughts on that? Because my understanding is that there is an intent to try to convert that to an outpatient.
Someone Karen from Saddleback. I'm here for any questions. I
that's
what I have. Lots of
questions.
Yeah, so if you have any questions, please. In August of 2014, Memorial Care made the decision to change their privately owned property into an ambulatory care center with advanced urgent care. We met with many, we had many hospital meetings. We had meetings with community representatives, with the cities, with our plan. We had been very transparent in this and what we were doing, and we met with some opposition from a small group of physicians, three physicians out of the 1,500 that are employed at Saddleback. And so over the last 18 months, it's been a pretty big roller coaster, to put it mildly. During that time, we've listened to the constituents out there in the community that wanted to keep the emergency department. They really weren't very concerned about the hospital itself, but in the state of California, as you all know, you can't have an ER without a hospital, acute care hospital attached to it. So we met with Senator Bates and Assemblyman Bill Bro, and they asked us to stay open for 1 year as we sought legislation changes to for freestanding ERs. I myself and many of our senior leadership team and my medical director, Mark Taub, went to Sacramento several times to meet with our assembly and the state senate. Unfortunately, the bill did not pass because they basically went down the party lines with the opposition from the California Nurses Association and SEIU, the other union. So so we lost, we failed in that. We knew that was a big step, you know, big, you know, we I tell you the truth, that was a tough one to get past, but we thought it was important to meet the community's response that they wanted the ER, and so that failed in January, and in February, the city in their attempt to keep us there and to force Memorial Care to rezone the property to an acute care hospital only, which tied the hands of Memorial Care. They could not go forward with their plans for an ambulatory care center, and it also is against the law and against the Constitution of the United States by doing spot zoning. So after many, many city council meetings and many abusive language headed towards myself, my medical director, my senior leadership, the board of directors at Memorial Care decided to close the hospital. It was not an easy decision. Nobody wanted, we did not want to leave. I didn't want to leave. I have, I've been there for 10 years now, and I had my daughter there in 1981, and they saved my mother's life in 1975. So I'm from that community, and I had a very vested interest in keeping it there. But at this point, we're probably going to seek litigation with, through the city of San Clemente for spot zoning that property. And we just have nowhere else to go. We can't sell it. We can sell it if somebody will buy it. We've had a couple interested parties. They have knocked on the door, but once they look at the zoning, they don't, they want, we actually had a psychiatric hospital that wanted to purchase it, which was like, oh, that would be great for that area, but they can't do it because it doesn't have an ER. So it's not an acute care hospital. So we are still looking. Our biggest challenge is our consolidated license. Somebody can't come in and just buy the place like it is because we're under the Saddleback Memorial. It's actually a hallway or an extension of Saddleback. So we have to de-license those beds, and the new owner would have to come in and meet Oshawott standards and earthquake standards, which that hospital is not on rockers. So it would, it's a big challenge. So that's where we are. it's sad and it's disappointing, but there's really no other choice for Memorial Care to keep the facility open. Our volumes, the other day I think we had six patients inside, you know, six inpatients. Three of those were observation, two in the ICU. Our volumes in the emergency department have remained steady over the last 10 years. They really haven't gone up or down. They've just kind of been the same for forever, around 15,000 a year. And so the ER is used, it is utilized quite often, and our acuity is very, very low though. We have like 0.7% of critical care patients there. So it's a very small acuity. But so that's where we are. Any other questions? Yeah, it's a tough situation. So we're dealing with the best we can. We are committed to stay open for the 90 days. We do have some staffing issues that I'm dealing with right now. We're having a lot of anger right now from the staff, as you can imagine. A lot of sick call. We only run with four nurses on days, four on nights, and so we had recent calls on Saturday, which is 75% of my staff. You know, and that creates challenges when you don't have nursing
everybody's
to fill those holes.
Sick calls a lot.
Yeah, the sick calls are. So we're pulling from our Laguna Hills campus to fill those holes. Our travelers, and but now we're shorting Laguna Hills campus, so now they go into Virgin. I mean, it's just it's a mess right now, and we're just hoping to get through it.
So who would absorb 15,000?
will be Mission Hospital and Laguna Hills.
And their current, I mean, I guess we look at their bypass time, but is that going to have a significant, are they capable of that?
It will. It'll have a significant impact on EMS. It'll have a significant impact on the community. It'll have a significant impact on Laguna Hills as well.
How far away, mileage-wise, is the next closest hospital? It's probably Mission, right?
It's 9 miles from San Clemente campus, 14.2 to Laguna Hills.
I was thinking it could be a critical access hospital, but I guess it's 25 miles.
It's not based on the population, exactly.
Because at least that would be a more affordable option if it was critical access, right?
Right.
Was that even considered? Can you get an exception to be a CH?
It's not an individual hospital. It's under a consolidated license.
Because it was,
yeah. So it's there. It's one hospital to campuses. Yeah.
So we fixed your options down in the zoning, it sounds like.
Zoning killed us. Yeah. It really killed us. That was their attempt to keep us open, to force our hand, but it doesn't. Tomorrow, I believe there's a picket going on at noon, so here you see that in the newspaper. It's been very disheartening to see the community that that I gave my career to and wanted to give back for being raised in San Clemente. I wanted to give back my nursing career to this community, and they failed to respond, so.
How far is the Pendleton Hospital away?
Well, it's in Oceanside. The newest one is off the freeway, but they're not ER. They are an ER, but they're really
you
a military base.
You can't access them, so
yeah.
The next closest one is Tri-City, clear down off the 78.
Yeah.
So I know different situations, like on Guam, there's only two hospitals, government and military. Mm-hmm. Civilians were allowed to go to the military ER, you know, stabilize and transfer, but yeah. Pendleton's not even closer, it sounds like, then.
No.
You're not a STEM center, you're not a stroke center, so really how many true emergent patients are coming to San Clemente anyways?
Right.
If they come in, you're going to stabilize and transfer them.
Right, and that's what we've been doing for years, and that's what, when I started 10 years ago, I brought my transport experience from the University of Utah and created a transport program for strokes and STEMIs so that we had rapid transport, because we don't have a cath lab, we don't have a stroke, we're not a stroke receiving center. And the community wants us to build those things, but you all know what the cost is to build a cath lab that's utilized, what, six times a year. So it's not an option, unfortunately. So yeah.
So it would have worked out with your urgent care center, basically.
It would have been beautiful.
No difference.
It would have been
come in,
really nice.
Treated, transferred, it would have been like nothing.
And we were going to try to make it an advanced urgent care, so we had ER physicians, ER nurses. You know, we had an urgent care track and an ER track, and then stabilize and transfer to Mission, transfer to, you know,
well, that top of that would be an ambulatory center.
No, couldn't have been a receiving center.
But the vast majority of patients are walking in.
They are, yeah. I think like 84% or something high are walking in. We have very low EMS volume. And most of those aren't. They're not traumas. They go to Mission. They're not heart attacks. They go to Mission. They're not strokes. They go to Mission. If they walk in and they're having a heart attack, that's when our transport team will get them. Yeah.
Well, it sounds like the city shot themselves in the head.
Yeah.
They did, unfortunately. And no matter, we all tried. Everyone tried to convince them. And unfortunately, it's the squeaky wheel that gets the attention. And the physician group that we were up against were very squeaky and very convincing. So we are committed to keeping the ER open. If something happens over the next 90 days where I can't physically possibly do it with staffing, we'll contact EMS and suspend our ERC at that time.
So
we don't want to do that.
Nobody comes and buys the hospital. What is the committee going to do then? Bail their own? I mean.
Well, they've talked about that. They have buyers, or they have plans to build one in Tulega. It's kind of like the Trump campaign. It's a lot of talk and not a lot of real action there. So I don't know what those are. They have buyers, but nobody's approached Memorial Care. So it's really sad. It's a sad, sad thing.
It's proof there's low volume there, so the reality for that hospital to exist as now doesn't.
It doesn't meet the triple aim, and it doesn't meet the Affordable Care Act. Is how we're moving forward as a healthcare system. It's just not anymore. And it is what it is.
Okay. Well, we wish you the best on that difficult situation.
Thank you for the opportunity.
When will the report be done? Your report.
We're working on it now. I don't know what the timeline is for it, as far as...
Probably be done before the public hearing.
Correct.
It'll be a complete draft for the public hearing, because we have to include public hearing comments in our report. So it'll be 99% for that, so we'll release the draft at that public hearing or prior to it, and then we have to finish it up with comments. And then we have to get it into CDPH within 60 days of their notice. So where the clock is ticking, and then CDPH has 30 days to make a decision.
Now, at this EMSC meeting, are you going to want representatives from Memorial Care, other than myself, to speak, or if for public comment, or?
Yeah, okay. I'm going to talk to you offline.
Okay.
Okay. On other business?
Okay. Anybody opposed to adjournment?
We do have a quorum, by the way.
We are, though. Okay. So since you're here, Sam, medical director's report.
Did we go over that? Adjourned.
Okay. Well, we covered everything.
I think we covered pretty much everything that's going on.
Okay, good. Anything else you want to say?
We can approve minutes.
We could have got out here a half hour early, but we waited for you to come back.
Oh.
We have a quorum, so we can approve the minutes.
Oh, we do have a quorum. You have the minutes of January 12th before you. I'll take a motion for approval. Is there a second?
Second.
Is there any discussion, comments, questions, changes? Anyone opposed to approval of the minutes? Okay, stand approved. Okay, thank you very much. We're done.
I'm a little dialogue.
I mean, there are